people say to me, well, high performing house, it's going to cost me 5 or 10% more for, you know, to build it. And I say, fine, let's make it 5 or 10% smaller. That's really easy to do. You know, it's it'll make us plan it efficiently, and it won't cost you any more, and it'll be way better.
That's Anne Salmond, and this is the Homestyle Green podcast. Welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. Hey, before we get on to today's show, are you a fan of the show? Hope you are if you're listening in. I am looking for some support at the moment to keep the show going. It's kind of self-funded. It's a bit of a hobby project, but it is getting some inspiration out there and getting a little bit of traction, which is really exciting to see. It's only a small audience compared to some of it's not a massive show. Typically we get 300, 400, sometimes 500 downloads, listens per episode, but I know that it's a really passionate audience. If you've got a business, whether you're running a practice, an architectural practice, or if you're selling a product, I imagine that getting the ears of up to 500 really passionate people could be something of value to you. If that's something that you are interested in and supporting the show, then I'd love to hear from you. I'm making some advertising spots available, and the point of that is to help the show, but it's also to get the message out there for products and services that are going to be beneficial to our really passionate audience. If that is of interest, please do get in touch, matthew@homestylegreen.com. I'd love to hear from you. And if you're just a regular listener who's enjoyed this content, found it useful, then head on over to homestylegreen.com and you can donate whatever you like using the Patreon button. There's a big button on the front page just called Patreon. You can click on there and it'll take you to a page where you can just choose whatever you prefer. If you want to shout me a cup of coffee or something more, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much for your support. Now let's get on to today's episode, which I'm very happy to have Anne Salmond on the show. I honestly thought I'd had her on before because we've spoken so many times in the past, and I've known Anne for quite a while around the sustainable design agriculture scene. In 2019, I heard her pop up on the radio talking to Catherine Ryan on Radio New Zealand, and that was in recognition of the fact that she had just been made a Distinguished Fellow of the New Zealand Institute of Architects. And this is a pretty high honour. It's only available to a maximum of just 10 people at one time. Now, Anne's been a trailblazer throughout her history. So, throughout her career as a architect. So, she's a very worthy recipient of this title. And she gave an anecdote early on that at one stage she was told that she was running the largest architecture firm in the country that was directed by women. So she's been an advocate for women in design. She's been a trailblazer in that space, as well as in sustainability. And in our interview, Anne and I discuss her interest in sustainable architecture, where that came from. We also talk a bit about passive solar versus passive house, Living Building Challenge, and some of the exciting projects that she's currently working on. Anyway, let's pick up the interview. We started out by discussing where Anne's interest in sustainability originally came from.
That started when I was at architecture school, because I was at architecture school during the first oil shocks, when it became clear that oil wasn't going to last forever and that we had to think about other ways of finding energy. My car was subject to carless days, and you were allowed to fill your car up on a Friday and not again until the following Monday, so you could only use one tank of petrol in the weekend, which I think had the unexpected effect of people taking long weekends when they weren't supposed to, coming right back on a Monday. But yeah. And my car used to be regularly siphoned because I had to park it on the street when when I was there, and I'd come up on a
Saturday.
Really?
So some people would steal your
fuel?
Yeah,
stealing, wow, stealing the petrol. So I think I went to Wellington Architecture School in its early days, and there was a focus there on engineering, both structural engineering, but also environmental science and engineering, which I think was pretty new for architecture students in New Zealand. And so we were made aware of those things at architecture school. I can remember a couple of things, little stories. One was writing away to the States for a book on solar, passive solar design, because there was nothing available in New Zealand. And you couldn't just Google it in those days. And the other thing was handing in a project at architecture school where I designed an earth-sheltered building for the middle of a national park. And so it had one elevation looking out over a lake through the bush, and the other three sides had earth mounded up and over the roof. And I thought I'd done a wonderful job of hiding this building in the national park, and I really was quite proud of what I'd done, only to be told by the tutor that I was cheating because I had only drawn one elevation and the other elevations were sort of a hill. And that if I didn't redo it by Monday the following week, she would fail me. So, wow. The attitudes have definitely changed. And that's one of the things that I've found really gratifying is watching what people know and what people want in their buildings really dramatically changing. From my early years as an architect where I had to sneak extra insulation into houses and specify hot water cylinders that had an extra coil for the future solar without really telling anyone. I just sort of did it and because I thought it was good for my clients to have that. Yeah. And probably if I'd mentioned it, then, they might have wanted to save some money and make the studs smaller and take out the insulation. So it's completely changed. Now my clients come to me because they know that I care about them and that's what they want. And, in fact, the move to doing passive houses and things has come from my clients. So now instead of pulling, I'm being pushed. Yeah.
So there's more drive from the market to ask for things like that. You don't have to do the sustainability by stealth.
Exactly.
Sneaking things in.
Our clients are really well informed about what they're doing, yeah.
And where do you think that's coming from? What's driving that interest?
I think it's years of organisations like the New Zealand Green Building Council and architects and the various energy bodies in New Zealand, years and years of banging away at the same story. You try to change something from the bottom up and it takes an awful lot of energy from a big, broad group of people. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you change stuff by legislation, it's really quick and the response in the market is really fast. I think of an example of double glazing. When I started work, double glazing wasn't the norm. And if you specified it was really expensive compared with standard glazing and people didn't really understand the benefits. Then suddenly the legislation changed and you had to have it. And so the cost came down and now a building that doesn't have double glazing is considered inferior. I think that that's going to go on happening. I think and hope that we're going to go on seeing higher and higher standards expected. That's what's happening in the UK and that's very dramatic there. That's what's been in Europe for a long time. And I think our standards will improve as our knowledge and commitment to meeting some of the international standards we've signed up to. We're members of international agreements that demand we do something about our CO2 emissions and about energy consumption in New Zealand. And so I think it's wonderful to see those things happening.
So going back to the oil shocks and then those things that you mentioned around energy, and the what we've signed up to as a country, the motivation there seems to be energy. You talk about solar power and being able to use solar thermal, thicker insulation. Have you been interested in other aspects as well, such as health, or has it mostly been about energy efficiency?
No, the whole purpose of making the buildings better is really for health and comfort. That's the driver. I don't, you know, people can decide to pay more or less for energy and they can conserve it, but that's absolutely not the focus. The energy efficiency is one element. The New Zealand Homestar system addresses a really wide range of other issues, water conservation, comfort, health.
Yeah.
Same with the Living Building Challenge, which really is probably my favourite of all the different ways of making an aspirational framework within which to work. And it considers beauty and community and materials, toxicity, and just a hugely wide range of different issues.
And have you had the opportunity to work on any Living Building Challenge projects?
Not one that's been submitted for assessment, no. I did the course and I've used it more as a way for me to check myself and my own design and approach to what I'm doing and trying to make sure that we've considered those things, and even if we haven't achieved them to the standard we might aspire to, that at least we address where we are on that scale. One of the biggest challenges in measuring your energy efficiency against, say, material toxicity is that often those two things are hard to reconcile. All the various foam insulations and things, you know, a lot of them come out of the oil industry. And it's one of those things, the more you know, the harder it is to be right.
So some of your best options for insulation might be PIR, for example. Question where it came from. UPVC windows, I know, is a challenge for a lot of people. They want it because they're really good thermally, but they're worried about the use of the UPVC.
That's true. And usually we select timber rather than PVC unless our clients, you know, really want it. But I think, on the other hand, you could become paralysed because you can't be perfect. Yes. And I actually take the approach that it's better to make sure that you're moving in the right direction with all your decisions, and that by considering these things within a framework, you can look at what you've added to a project and know that it's better because of your input than it would have been without it, and that you're trying to make the building the best it can be. And for each building, there's a different balance. You know, some buildings, it's just all about the people and the performance, the function of it. That's the prime part of the brief. Other people might come to us wanting a passive house building and they're totally focused on energy, but they're not so worried about the other things. If you do a Living Building Challenge building, you have to do everything and you want to, but then you might find that it pushes the cost of the building up and that it takes longer and that there's more consultation required and all sorts of other impacts for the building. So I think architecture is one of those things where you've got to be a jack of all trades and a master of some, and you have to know when to pull in experts and when to get help. And in the end, there's a lot of decision making, and to become incapable of moving a project on because you can't get everything right is not helpful either.
So I think that's a pragmatic approach of taking something like Living Building Challenge, which is so comprehensive and so detailed if you're going to go all the way, but still useful as a overall guide. If someone doesn't want to go all the way, you can use it to inform those decisions along the way.
Exactly. And because of the sort of petal analogy, the flower with petals analogy, you can just pick a few petals that suit the client's values and priorities and focus on those. And as long as you don't forget about the others, you know, I'm noticing doing these passive house buildings, there are a lot of compromises that you make in other areas in order to perfect the energy performance. And sometimes you've feel fine about those, and you know, the things work together and the whole building gets better. And other times there are compromises that are a direct result of trying to get that really high energy performance. So
have you got some examples of the types of things that you
Probably building form is the simplest and most obvious one. We were looking at two buildings that we've assessed on the PHPP, or rather Jessica Ayers has done that for us. Two different buildings. One's a two-story rectangle, essentially, and the other one is three rectangles pretty much in a line, one of them offset. So it's quite a spread-out building with a big perimeter area for the area enclosed. Both of those things are driven by town planning and by the site. One of them's got a height restriction of 4.5 metres, so there's no opportunity to have a two-storey building. And it's on a steep, rocky slope. So really spreading the building long along the contours is the most cost-effective and sensible way to place the building on the site. But when we looked at the energy use, even with exactly the same construction, the two-storey rectangular box uses between 20 and 25% less energy.
Wow. So that's to do with the surface volume ratio,
is it? Exactly. And so you could spend hours analysing every thermal bridge and save a little bit of energy. But actually, as with all of architecture, really the big decisions that have the biggest effect are all made in the early stages of the design process. So form, the size. I mean, people say to me, well, a high-performing house, it's going to cost me 5 or 10% more for, you know, to build it. And I say, fine, let's make it 5 or 10% smaller. That's really easy to do. You know, it'll make us plan it efficiently and it won't cost you any more and it'll be way better.
And do people push back on that? Do they want to maximise the size?
No, mostly they don't. In fact, sometimes we're coming up against developers who've put minimum sizes for their houses on their on the covenants for the project, which seems mad.
Still going on.
So somebody comes in and says, well, I have to build a house of 200 square metres or something, and you say, well, okay, let's just make your big garage and then we'll make you a sensible house, you know. It goes on being interesting, and that's one of the things I love about my job and my career is that there's always something new to learn and you never get bored, and you know, every client comes with new challenges and every site's different and interesting, so I feel very lucky to be you know, doing something I enjoy so much.
I want to talk about the transition from passive solar to passive house and those. You know, you got that book from the States and learned about, I guess, the orientation, big eaves, lots of thermal mass, big windows and exposed concrete. Yep. What did you think? Do you remember the first time you heard about passive house and the concepts like airtightness and what your initial reaction was to that?
I think probably my initial reaction was that this was really appropriate for Europe, where they have snow for 3 months of the year and thick walls and small windows and, you know, just a different history in their architecture and different climate and things. So I suppose when I first looked at it, I looked at it as an outsider, thinking this is what someone else is doing, that's interesting. I think people do get a bit confused between passive solar, as you say, as I was taught it, and passive house. They are very different. It was a surprise to me that I didn't have to think about the site so much. The site wasn't such a big impact on a passive house as it is on solar passive. If you do a passive solar design, you really want a good north-facing aspect, and you you are trying to use that solar energy to heat and the structure of the house to store the heat and give it back. But if you are on a south-facing clay bank in Wellington, which is where I started my architectural career, then it's not quite so easy to achieve that. So that's where passive house is better, because it doesn't require a whole lot of thermal mass and it focuses on insulation and, yeah, insulation and air tightness. And therefore you can make a warm, comfortable house in almost any environment and with almost any orientation. So I think that makes it very useful for, well, down here in Wanaka where I'm working, where it's often quite cold, and therefore these things have more benefit maybe.
Certainly you get the extremes down in central Otago, Queenstown, Wanaka. But like you say, I think the concepts are, well, they're definitely relevant across all climate regions. Do you struggle now with explaining that to people? Do you still get clients to say, oh, it's a European thing?
No, not so much. Most of the clients we have who want passive house, they already know what it is. I think sometimes they're not aware of the implications of the decision they make, you know, so they don't realise that if they say, I want a passive house, that they may have to make some compromises they weren't expecting. And if they don't want to make those compromises, then it will cost them more, because they'll have to put more fabric and more insulation in. If they want enormous windows and they want an H-shaped plan and they want, you know, then they're going to have to balance those things out. But I'm a bit of a, as you said before, a pragmatist and a bit of an 80-20 person. So I do struggle a bit with the preciseness of passive house and the fact that they're absolute standards. I do a lot of what I call high-performance houses. And for those, I'm very happy with an air tightness of under one. I don't feel it needs to be 0.6. And I still think we get a very good performance out of the building. I am happy if we meet the low energy standard, the passive house low energy standard, and not the ultimate, because sometimes other things are important to our clients. Their indoor-outdoor flow and their acoustic separation of spaces in the house, and lots of other drivers that would...
And the site, like you say. And I mean, it's pretty hard to imagine a site anywhere around Wanaka and Queenstown that doesn't have a pretty stunning view in one direction,
which exactly
kind of has to be honoured in the design.
It does, and that's where I like the Living Building Challenge, because passive house helps you achieve the energy petal, you know, that's perfect for that. But all the other things still do need to be considered. And, you know, it's a joy to think about those things and make sure that you try to incorporate them in your design. Yeah. And probably like all architects, we aspire to try to make every next project as perfect as we can in these ways.
Yeah.
There are always compromises and, you know, you never manage to achieve everything that you start out to. But often when the building is built, you get some wonderful surprises as well. So, you know, little special glimpses of views or ways that your clients use the building that you hadn't anticipated. Yeah. Or one of the things that I like is when a building that's been in the world for a while has a new purpose or a new owner and has to be adjusted, and then some of the flexibility and adaptability that we've designed in really gets used, and that's very satisfying too.
And you do a bit of you don't just do new residential, you do some renovation work, and you also do a little bit of commercial work as well.
Quite a lot of alterations and additions actually, although I've done in my life fewer down in Wanaka because they're just the housing stock isn't as big, and so most of the projects are new projects. Just last Friday, I just went to see a large addition to a house down here completed, And the owners were really pleased because they said that some of the visitors to the house couldn't tell where the old house ended and the new house began. Mm-hmm. And they said that they had got what they wanted out of the addition and out of the house. So, nice. You know, that's really satisfying. And alterations are interesting because you have to work with what's already there, and you see what the previous construction was, and you have to try to get your brain into the thought process and the ideas of whoever designed it.
Yeah,
so I find that
makes it super challenging.
Yeah, interesting and challenging. And the commercial work, a lot of the work that I do here, it's either hospitality or retail, or it's community work like the Luggett Hall. So
tell us about the Luggett Hall. We started talking about that before recording, but that sounds like a very exciting project.
Yeah, the old Memorial Hall in Luggett has been condemned and will have to be demolished because of its poor earthquake performance. It's built out of unreinforced clay bricks, which are just basically stacked up and could fall down on people at any moment. However, it has lasted quite a long time, but it no longer meets the code. And so also Luggett community is growing, and the site that it's on isn't really, and the hall aren't really going to be large enough. So we've designed a new hall for the Queenstown Lakes District Council, and we've been talking about Passive House. It is going to be Passive House standard building, and I think the first Passive House standard community building in New Zealand. And that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I mean, in a way, it's simple because it is a simple form. It's just a box. It's a well-insulated box. It also has some challenging use characteristics in that it has to be able to be used by, you know, a small group of six or eight people having a meeting at one end and 230 people watching a show or a concert at the other end. So that really, that gives some challenges for the performance of it. But it's a very exciting opportunity to be able to design a building that's going to be part of a community for, you know, a very long time, and having to try to design it so it will still perform as appropriately in 50, 70, maybe even 100 years as it does when it's built. And so, that's what we're working on at the moment.
I hope so. I mean, like, it's been around, like, it's been there for a while. It's a tiny place, but a significant part of New Zealand history, and that puts it right on the map in architectural terms as well, because, like you say, that will be a first to have a community hall in New Zealand to that standard.
Yeah,
and coming back to that flexibility point, how do you do that? Because I know that there are some people who've lived in their family home in, say, here in Auckland, and it's fine with four people in, but when they even having a dinner party, you get five or six extra bodies into a passive house, and it warms up quite a lot. So how do you do that with the capacity to go up to 100 people?
You do it with some serious ventilation systems.
Right.
Basically, yeah. Mechanical services are the answer to that. There are big windows and things, and obviously you can open the windows and doors, and the users can manage it to that extent. But when you have a show, you've got the doors closed because you don't want the noise going out over the community and annoying people. So it has been designed for maximum capacity, and that's adds some cost to the building. In fact, in this building, there's quite an interesting solution for the mechanical services, because there are two plants. There's a small plant that's capable of ventilating the building for up to about 40 people, which is quite a predominant use of the hall. They have yoga classes and play groups and all sorts of community meetings and things, which mostly are going to be fewer than 40 people in the hall. So the smaller unit copes with it then, and then there's a CO2 measuring capacity, which tells the bigger unit when it needs to kick in. And so for larger gatherings, you would be running the bigger system. And right. that also means you've got some redundancy as well. So it means that if one of these systems needs to be maintained or something, then the other one's still going. And it would, of course, doesn't over-ventilate when you don't need it. So it's been quite a clever design by a mechanical services engineer.
That is quite clever because, like you say, most of the time it'll be far below that maximum, but you've got to design it for the maximum. But, you know, 80, probably 90% of the time it's going to be far fewer than that.
So, but look, I'm a very recent, Passive House has not been, you know, the driver for my work. I've really mostly spent my time on what I would call high-performance houses because most of our clients have got quite strict budgets and most of them are happy to find a place on that sliding scale between what's legally required and, if you like, the ultimate of passive house at the other end. And so what I find is that the PHPP spreadsheets are really useful for showing you how your building's going to perform anyway, whether it reaches passive house standard or not. The ability to predict the performance and explain what it's likely to be to your client and let them be part of the decision about how they want to how they want the building to be designed to perform is really good. I'm really very very interested in having good information on which to make decisions, and that's what it gives you, good information to predict the performance. But I also think it's really important to measure the performance afterwards. And I've found it quite surprising that in Passive House there's no requirement to actually do that. And maybe it's because people operate buildings in unpredictable ways and so you can't necessarily guarantee that the building will be run to get the best performance out of it. But I've done quite a lot of post-occupancy evaluation and that allows you to close the loop from what you've designed and built and assess its performance and use, not just its energy performance, but how it works for the people who live in it, who work in it, who clean it, who maintain it, and feed that back into the design process so that you slowly learn and get better at what you're designing, and also that you try not to repeat the same mistakes. You find new ones. I noticed you find new mistakes to make all the time, but you try not to repeat the ones you've already made.
Anything surprising or outstanding that you've learned from doing monitoring?
Probably the most interesting one was I did some work for Wellington City Council on their social housing, and they had a lot of money from the government to do an upgrade project, and they used post-occupancy evaluation of the buildings before they were upgraded to inform the brief about what was wrong with the buildings, where the needs were. And then again after the upgrade to really see whether what they'd done had worked. And it was absolutely amazing to go into these kind of under-maintained social housing buildings and see the effect of poor ventilation, poor insulation, lack of heating and security issues on how the people who lived there felt. And then going back afterwards and seeing not only the impact on health and comfort of the changes that have been made, but also the impact on how people felt about where they lived, their care for the environment inside their homes and also outside their homes. It was really noticeable that it had an uplifting effect overall, and people felt they weren't only healthier, they felt more comfortable, they felt safer, they felt more secure, and they felt more loved.
So was that from surveys or qualitative assessments as well as pure data?
Yeah, it was qualitative. Basically, first of all, a qualitative assessment to try to identify where the issues were. So we interviewed residents over quite a big cross-section. We interviewed the managers of the from Wellington City Council. We interviewed the consultants who were doing the upgrade and who'd done the design in some cases. We interviewed the cleaners and the maintenance guys and tried to get a sort of 360 picture of how the building worked. And then where there were issues that were clearly a problem, like, for instance, security in some of these places was a real problem, then we could bring in a specialist CPTED, is it? Crime prevention in design expert to come and help make those things better. Yeah. If the problem was mold and cold, then you know, we could start measuring things, or actually I didn't do that, somebody else did that, but yeah. And so it's really a it's a great way to close the loop, and it gives you real data and evidence that what you're doing is working. Because I think one of the problems with trying to build better is that you can tell people that it's going to be good, but they want the evidence in terms of health and comfort, which I think's pretty much been collected now, and they also want the financial business case for it. And I think we really do need to put a bit of focus on gathering all that information that designers and builders and owners of buildings all around New Zealand have, and try to find a way to pull it together so that we can prove how much better buildings are when these things are thought of.
No, I think you're right. I think a lot of people don't really appreciate just how cold their houses are or how damp they are as well. And it's relatively easy to measure temperature relative humidity inside houses, but because we don't have sophisticated control systems, we typically don't have anything that's measuring those. But yeah, it's relatively easy to do these days. So I agree. I think we should be doing more post-occupancy testing.
Yeah. Anyway, that's I sound a bit like a kind of nerd, but I'm not at all. I actually struggle with getting to the detail. I'm much more of an 80-20 person in my general approach to what I do. I am not obsessed with being perfect and ticking the boxes. I'm much more interested in how the buildings perform for the people who are living in them. And so I either make myself do it, or I work with other people who enjoy doing the measurement. And that's
Well, and clearly you do very well to balance the form and the function as well. The quick browse through some of your portfolio work, your designs and your team, there's clearly no there's no compromise on the aesthetic and the beauty of the design and the form of the house. So there's doesn't have to be the compromise there. You can have a great looking house as well as one that performs well.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I hope that's the case. I think probably, though, I do keep things quite simple. Mostly our buildings are collections of simple forms. I don't go in for, you know, great big cantilevered structures that need a lot of steel structure to hold them up, because I know what that steel structure is going to do to my building if I don't insulate it carefully. And so I tend to like quite simple forms. I think they last better. I think they don't they might not be the height of fashion at the time that they're built, so they're a bit more classic in terms of their appearance. But then 10 years later, when the client comes back and asks us to add on to the building, I look at them and think, well, it could still have been built last year.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, I think there's something a little bit timeless about that sort of open plan, almost the barn-style vernacular as well, particularly in that Otago region in central South Island. but I guess anywhere as well, it is a bit timeless because it's simple and there is beauty in that simplicity.
And hopefully some cost efficiency too. Mm, you know, a builder once told me that when he prices a house, he prices it all up and then he goes around and counts the corners and adds so much a corner.
Right.
Yes. And I think that you can kind of understand why. So,
yeah. Cool. Hey, well, it's been a pleasure to finally have you on the show. And it's really, I have admired your work for a long time and your courage to do things before others have been doing them. You know, I remember looking at a design of yours a long time, a few years before it became a requirement to do insulated slabs, for example, and you were already looking at ways to insulate the edge of concrete slabs because you knew that was a good idea. You're definitely a worthy recipient of being recognised in the architecture community here in New Zealand. Where's the best place for people to find your practice and see some of your work?
I'm based in Wanaka. My website is salmondarchitecture.co.nz, and otherwise just probably Google me and you'll get me and you'll also get my famous relation, Dayman Salmond. Don't get confused. But, hopefully I'm not difficult to find. And thank you for interviewing me. We haven't even talked about my latest enthusiasm for prefabrication, but we'll do that another time.
Indeed, we will have to get Anne back on the show sometime to talk all about prefabrication. That was distinguished fellow Anne Salmond of Salmond Architecture. You can find her at salmondarchitecture.co.nz. Or you can head over to the show notes for this episode at homestylegreen.com/223, episode 223. And I'll put some links to her website and all the fine projects and some of the work that she's been involved in. You can have a look. Check it out there. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm really keen to hear from you if you are keen to get your brand, your service or your product out to our passionate audience. Could be worth a lot to you by picking up a couple of clients, someone who is really interested in making a better place to live, because that's what this show is all about. If you are interested, please do get in touch, matthew@homestylegreen.com. I'd love to hear from you. Or if you're just a passionate listener and would like to contribute towards the show and our running costs, then you can head over to the homepage and just click on the Patreon button. And you can donate whatever you feel is appropriate. Thank you very much for tuning in. Now, do go and make a better place to live.